Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board. Today, we meet two groups of musicians, one in Appalachia, one in Wales. They connected through old-time music and they swapped tunes at festivals in each country. With these gatherings on hold this summer, today we hear a virtual music concert featuring music from the British Isles and Galax, Virginia. We also hear a story of a family-owned black newspaper in Virginia. The publisher, Claudia Whitworth, is rejecting the idea that people only want to hear negative stories.
Every front page of his paper would have murders, rapes, something. And I said, why on earth would you do something like this when that's what people think of us anyhow? And he said, because good news doesn't sell.
And that strategy has worked. Her paper is still going strong and just celebrated its 80th anniversary. You'll hear these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board. We're doing two things in today's show that at first glance may seem at odds. First, we'll explore an issue that has become a flashpoint for political divides in our country, Confederate monuments, and the history of oppression that these monuments represent to many. But today's show is about more than what divides. It's also about what bridges us, despite our many differences. We begin in Roanoke, Virginia, where a newspaper is still thriving after 80 years. The Roanoke Tribune is a family-owned African-American newspaper. Back in early March, as the pandemic was just starting to unfold, reporter Mason Adams went to see the newspaper staff in action and learn about how they've survived all these years.
Wednesday nights are the busiest part of the week at the Roanoke Tribune. That's the day that 4,500 copies of the weekly paper show up from the printer. It's all hands on deck as the staff gathers the fold, label and stack each paper so that they can go to the post office before the day's last mail run. The Roanoke Tribune isn't just a community paper. It's a family paper, owned and operated by a family that's been doing this for four generations. And three generations are here this evening. Claudia Shaw is the youngest to have picked up the family business.
Probably started about five or six folding papers.
Her mother, Eva Shaw Gill, started working at the paper as a child too.
Most kids have chores to wash dishes and make up their bed. We had to come to the Tribune.
Then there's Stan Hale, Eva's older brother.
Stan the man. Yeah, baby. They say you look like a machine when you get started.
Stan's the paper's spark plug, and he's really fast at folding papers.
Been everything, worn all the hats from time to time. Been here since... Well, actually, I started when I was about 11 years old.
In the eye of the storm stands publisher Claudia Whitworth, age 92. Claudia, spelled with a C, or C. Laudia, to distinguish her from her granddaughter, K. Laudia, started in the newspaper business in 1945. She bought the paper from her father in 1971 and continues to publish today. Her philosophy? To shine a positive light on Roanoke's black community.
Always the positive. I said no negatives. Like a letter from home.
Claudia's focus on positivity has occasionally brought her into conflict with her peers in the publishing industry. She remembers going to a national conference of black-owned and operated newspapers several years ago and getting into a debate with a tabloid publisher from the West Coast.
And I had to question him. I said, every front page of his paper would have murders, rapes, something. And I said, why on earth would you do something like this when that's what people think of us anyhow? You know, I challenged him in the national conference, and he said, because good news doesn't sell. And I said, okay, I'm going to prove you wrong. And none of them exist. Every one of them are out of, and my little good news don't sell is still out here and hadn't missed an issue.
Claudia's father, the Reverend F.E. Alexander, founded the Roanoke Tribune in 1939. Claudia went to work there 6 years later, but she quickly grew frustrated, partly because her father limited what she could do because she was a woman. So she started a pattern of moving to work on black newspapers elsewhere, then coming back home. That's how she learned the business. Claudia vividly remembers the joy she found in the physical process of setting type and arranging letters onto the page. When she started out, that process involved arranging molten lead alloys in a linotype machine. When they cooled, they'd form slugs that would be used to press ink onto newsprint paper.
You dump all of it in, and you put the fire under it, and it all melts, and then the dirt all floats to the top. And I would had a thing that you skim the dirt off, and that just pure metal, just shiny as new, every week. And it just had sort of a spiritual thing to it, how you can skim that dust off and just be pure again.
They looked like gold bars. They were just
silver. Uh-huh. I loved it. I loved everything about it.
Claudia worked at newspapers in Dayton, Cleveland, Columbus, Ohio, and in New York City. But she never forgot where she came from.
Well, my intention was always to come back and take care of my own paper, but I just needed experience.
Claudia took full control of the Roanoke Tribune in 1971 when she bought it from her father. She since has forged a powerful legacy with the Roanoke Tribune. For the nearly 30% of Roanokers who identify as African American, the Tribune serves as a positive reflection of their community. She's kept it going, even through a time when newspapers around the country are struggling to stay in business.
Well, she's a force of nature. That's exactly what she is. She's a larger-than-life personality. She is a very driven woman. She always has been.
That's Reginald Sharif, a political science professor at Radford University, who grew up in Roanoke and literally wrote the book on the city's black history. The Tribune has been a consistent presence his entire life.
Yeah, well, I don't know when I don't remember it because we received a subscription at home, and it was a way for everybody in Roanoke to keep up with what was going on in the black community, but also for those who had moved away. So at a time when many African-American people felt invisible in our communities, those black newspapers, both locally and nationally, kept us informed.
And it kept readers informed, even during difficult periods. Beginning in the 1950s, Roanoke City government demolished dozens of neighborhoods blocks to make way for a new interstate, civic center, and other redevelopment. Urban renewal also destroyed much of Roanoke's black business district, a longtime cultural hub that had attracted touring jazz musicians, as well as pioneering filmmaker Oscar Micheaux. The Roanoke Tribune was located there, too. Claudia remembers how she learned that the Tribune was being torn down.
My phone rings at 8 o'clock in the morning. They said, do you know they bulldozed in the Tribune? They bulldozed the Tribune and everything.
With all the equipment
over
inside.
That night. I come there, my stuff is all in the sidewalk and everything. They had bulldozed everything.
Even through all that, Claudia never missed an issue. She had kept photo setting equipment at home and so was able to keep publishing, even after her building was destroyed. The Roanoke Tribune persisted, moving to its current location on Melrose Avenue. They've adopted new technology over the years, too, incorporating computers and publishing not only in print, but online. It takes an iron will and high standards to keep a newspaper going, especially through all that. You can see that in how Claudia has raised her children and grandchildren.
One thing she's always been on me about is my grammar, how I speak,
she's on
how I walk, my posture.
Everybody about that.
No, oh, yeah.
Everybody about that. It's old school.
Remember I told you I moved away. I was gone for 15 years, and I used to write my mom letters every week.
I had edited them.
And when I get home, she has all my letters marked. Circle.
Edited.
Mm-hmm.
So capitalized.
I said, instead of her being happy to hear from me, I got to see all of this pile of mail edited. You should have said this. You should have used that word.
Yes, your past participles.
Oh, Lord.
The Roanoke Tribune carries on, even as the novel coronavirus pandemic shut down most of America. But the Tribune is still going. It's still publishing. It survived Jim Crow laws. It survived the destruction of its building during urban renewal. And now it's surviving the pandemic and the death of print. What's its secret? I think the answer can be found on Wednesday nights, when the staff gathers to process papers and deliver them to their community. This isn't just a newspaper. It's a family. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Mason Adams in Roanoke, Virginia.
A newspaper that's more than ink on paper. The Roanoke Tribune's mission is making and recording Black history since 1939. Lately, there's been quite a lot of that history in the making to write about, from protests over police brutality to debates over Confederate statues. The history of slavery and racism in our country runs beneath and through so much of what we currently experience. That context is complicated, especially in West Virginia, the only state to have been born from the Civil War. West Virginia seceded from Virginia 157 years ago to join the Union and reject the Confederate States of America. Despite West Virginia's birth story, though, Confederate monuments still exist across the state. Dave Mistich takes a look at the debate and what some historians say about a galvanizing moment in America as protests over racial injustice continue.
There are 21 statues, memorials, and other markers honoring Confederate generals and soldiers in the state, according to data compiled by the Southern Poverty Law Center. The names of Southern generals and soldiers mark the names of state park resorts, schools, and larger statues tower in public view. Given West Virginia's split from Virginia and thus the Confederacy, memorials to those who fought for the South serve as a historical paradox. One Boston-based historian and educator has an explanation for how they wound up here. Kevin Levin focuses on public memory in the Civil War. He notes that the United Daughters of the Confederacy gave some of the monuments to communities in West Virginia during the Jim Crow era of segregation and the Civil Rights Movement.
We always need to remember that the monuments always reflect the values of the community, the individuals and organizations that erected them and dedicated them originally.
Levin says that most of the efforts to remove monuments have been in larger cities with more diverse populations. But he says, even though statues remain intact here, the fact that West Virginians are even discussing the issue is remarkable.
I think where to look and one way to measure sort of the progress, if you want to call it that, is to look at the places that are even debating this issue.
Much of the conversation here has focused on Thomas Jonathan Stonewall Jackson, a Confederate general who was born in 1824 in present-day Clarksburg, West Virginia. Jackson, who owned six slaves, is memorialized in more than a dozen states and is one of the most recognizable figures of the Civil War. The Harrison County Commission rejected a motion to remove a statue of Jackson that stands in front of the courthouse in downtown Clarksburg. Many who attended the meeting, either in person or virtually, argued that removing the statue of Jackson would be an effort to quote-unquote erase history. Larry Starkey was one resident who spoke against removing the statue.
Where do we let it in? When do we let it in? Are we going to be like everybody else, see people burning because of an opinion, because you don't like this or you don't like that? Should we change Robert C. Byrd's name because he was in the KKK at one time? Should we change the Italian festival because Mussolini fought against the United States government? That's all foolishness. You can't change history.
But there were others who called for the statue of General Jackson to be removed, including two men who identified themselves as distant relatives. Colin Grant Jackson called into the meeting from Illinois.
If you want to talk about whose birthright this is and whose opinion should be heard, it seems like I have some qualifications here. I personally believe that this statue does not belong in front of a building that is supposed to be devoted to impartial justice.
Despite the commission voting against removal, some locals and others concerned about the message the statue sends say they'll continue to fight to bring it down. There's an ongoing campaign to lobby members of the commission to reconsider the issue. In Charleston, a bust and statue of Jackson are on display on the grounds of the state capitol. A middle school there, which has the state's highest percentage of Black students, bears his name. Bishop Wayne Crozier of Charleston has been part of the effort to rename Stonewall Jackson Middle School.
There is a difference between remembering history and revering history. No one is saying that forget it, but we don't have to act, we don't have to make heroes out of monsters.
Discussions are ongoing about possibly renaming the school after influential Black educator Booker T. Washington, Carter G. Woodson, or NASA mathematician Katherine Johnson. Crozier says he's focused on the school because renaming it would be a tangible change that would have lasting impact. He says too often, protests of racial injustice do not bring about significant progress.
A lot of times I just sort of wonder, okay, what happens after the protest is over? And I think sometimes the power structure just sort of, okay, we'll wait until this blows over and we return to the status quo.
While activists push for a more sensitive name for the school, the Kanawha County Board of Education says they will consider the issue at its July 6th meeting. But some board members are pushing back on the idea to rename Stonewall Jackson Middle School. Here's Becky Jordan.
I feel like maybe this is a knee-jerk option that, you know, with all the craziness and the sadness that's happened in our country, that this is a bigger push because, I mean, we've heard mumblings of, you know, some people over the years wanting to change Stonewall, but it never got any energy. It never really got moving.
Some who support memorials to Jackson argue that he should be judged by his respectable deeds, such as conducting a Sunday school for enslaved Black people and encouraging their literacy. The American Civil War Museum has said that these facts serve as, quote, a foundation for great misunderstanding in allowing Confederate heritage activists to attempt to distance the South's cause away from slavery. College of Southern Maryland professor of history and West Virginia native Dr. Cicero Fain also says considering figures like Jackson in such a way overlooks a fundamental question in the current debate.
The ultimate barometer by which one should judge a slaveholder is, did he make the ultimate sacrifice and shift away from the economic imperative and instead embrace a moral imperative. And he didn't.
Unlike monuments in other places, those erected in West Virginia have seen no reported vandalism. Fain says he believes statues here will remain standing unless there are dramatic systemic changes, especially with high-ranking public officials mostly mum on the matter.
I don't think the state population is sufficient, the Black population is sufficient to really bring about significant change without the power brokers, corporate, education, as well as government bringing about having some real hard conversations.
Republican Governor Jim Justice says the memorials at the state capitol are an issue for the legislature to decide, but he's avoided saying whether he wants to see them taken down.
And so from my standpoint, I don't know how to answer it any more plainly than just that. You know, I don't think I have any right to make a decision. I think that's a legislative right. From the standpoint of my personal beliefs, I don't feel like that anyone should feel uncomfortable here. This is our capital. This is our state. This is our people.
But state code gives the authority to decide the fate of the statues on the Capitol grounds to a commission, which the governor partially appoints. As for monuments located elsewhere, those decisions are in the hands of local governments, boards, or maybe, albeit unlikely, protesters themselves. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Dave Mistich.
That's the sound of over 100 people, both Black and white, marching in downtown Charleston, West Virginia, in front of the Board of Education building. They held a rally last weekend to protest the name of the local middle school, named after Confederate General Stonewall Jackson. Next, we head over to Murray, Kentucky, where a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee stands on the grounds of the Callaway County Courthouse. Residents are now asking for its removal. A local football coach and former U.S. Marine Sherman Neal sparked the debate when he wrote a public letter about what the statue represents to him as a Black man. Ohio Valley Resource reporter Liam Nehemiah recently caught up with Neal to hear his story.
Raising kids isn't easy, and even for U.S. Marine Corps veteran Sherman Neal, who shares that name with Union General William Tecumseh Sherman. At one point, his three-year-old son, Jet, tried to grapple up a bookshelf.
No, you don't need to go up there.
No!
This is the family time Neal's been missing for years while he served in the Corps. He's missed out on seeing his daughter born because he was deployed in Kuwait.
Like I said, my son's about to turn four. Like, for his first 3 years, I might have saw him collectively a year of that.
After leaving the Marines, he moved to Murray last year to pursue a dream of coaching football and joined the Murray State University coaching staff. Yet before he accepted the offer, he Googled Murray. The first thing he saw was Confederate General Robert E. Lee, specifically a statue of him installed in 1917 and funded by the United Daughters of the Confederacy. On June 1st, Neal published an open letter calling for the Confederate monument with that statue on the Cowley County Courthouse grounds to come down. Neal says having it near the courthouse is racist intimidation.
With it having been built in 1917 and knowing about the genesis of where all these came from, I don't know how you can make a legitimate argument that you're not doing that, given the comments by Robert E. Lee himself, Robert E. Lee's son.
He didn't mention in the letter that he's a football coach, or a veteran, or a licensed attorney. He wanted to see how people would respond to him as simply a fellow citizen. Since then, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, Murray State University, and former Murray State basketball star John Morant have all called for its removal. The statue has become a flashpoint for protest in a normally quiet town of about 19,000 in a county that's about 92% white. A petition in favor of the removal has at least 9,700 signatures. Another opposing it has more than 2,500. On June 17th, county leadership invited Neal to speak at their monthly meeting, along with another Murray resident who wants the statue to remain.
So we have the opportunity, slightly behind, you know, a couple other cities.
Neal wanted county government to at least pass a resolution stating intent to remove the statue. But Judge Executive Kenny Imes declined to do anything that day, saying he needed to sort out unspecified legal issues with the statue.
It makes it difficult for any person on any side, you know, to know where we're at right now with this process, or if anybody's even listening.
After the meeting, Neal debated the issue farther with the Murray resident who opposed the removal.
And vice versa. Many people in
this.
So
history. Where does it end?
Do we take every statue?
The resident compared the removal to cultural genocide and implied Neal hadn't lived in Murray long enough to speak on this. He said those advocating for removal had Marxist intent and hated the United States and God. Neal says he doesn't buy it.
Am I a communist? Am I a citizen? I'm in the wrong place. Is it the wrong time? Like, just, you know, what sticks to the wall?
Neal says he's disappointed, but still pushing ahead. He's looking to have a university-hosted community forum about the statue. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Liam Niemeyer.
Conversations about racism can certainly be divisive, but they can also reveal solidarity. Residents of Whitesburg, Kentucky, recently found themselves in the midst of their own racial reckoning. It came after one of the county's highest elected officials criticized Black Lives Matter protests in a Facebook post. Reporter Sydney Bowles of WMMT has this story about the community's response.
Terry Adams is the Letcher County Judge Executive, and he posted to Facebook shortly after a peaceful protest in downtown Whitesburg in support of Black Lives Matter. In his post, he called the movement, quote, a nonsense issue, and said racism didn't exist in Letcher County. The people playing the race card were the real racists, he said, and the protesters had an underlying agenda. So a few days later, 19-year-old Letcher Countyan Deja Hogg approached the lectern at a county fiscal court meeting, looked Judge Adams right in the eyes, and spoke.
I know COVID's going on right now, so just imagine there's no COVID, normal society, and imagine that you walk around and it's like you have to play.
Hogg is biracial, and Adams and every other county magistrate is white. Hogg gripped the lectern to steady herself and continued.
People look at you, and it's almost as if they stare too long, they breathe the same air, they're scared they're going to catch the plague. That is just a small, small glimpse of what it was like growing up here in Eastern Kentucky as a minority.
Letcher County is 98% white. Donald Trump got 80% of the vote in 2016. But it's also home to a progressive community that hosts drag shows and punk shows. It's got a solar-powered fire department and a thriving art scene. There are layers of complexity that often get lost in the media coverage of Trump country, but also in the polarized landscape of social media. Hogg is sharing her story, tearing open old wounds, as she calls it, after Judge Adams' comments ignited a debate across the county. People argued viciously in the Facebook comments, defending Black lives, defending Confederate statues, disputing whether looting was justified. Deja Hogg wasn't the only person who attended the meeting with county officials. She was joined by, among others, residents Tanya Turner, Nate Thompson, and Michella Phipps.
You made a lot of assumptions in that post. You assumed that none of us lived here. A man who was asking for my votes 2 years ago.
Anyone can say, well, I'm not racist, but at that point, then I have to ask them, do you really know what racism is?
Seeing people murdered on video, it's not just a problem somewhere else. There have been Black murders in Letcher County. And if you think otherwise, then you don't know our history.
Judge Adams looked uncomfortable as he listened to each speaker. He had tears in his eyes. When I spoke with him in his office a few days later, on Juneteenth, he apologized if he had hurt anyone.
I didn't realize there's as much tension locally as they are. I should not have brought what's national, going on nationally, and combined it with people wanting to speak out locally.
But Hogg says that's exactly why she's fighting, to convince people like Judge Adams that her experience in Whitesburg is connected to the experiences of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, whose killings sparked a nationwide reckoning. It's connected by the same forces that shape so much of Appalachian life: resource extraction, poverty, and being looked down on by outsiders.
And then they don't want anything to be an issue, and so race kind of just gets swept under the rug, which is where you get the institutionalized racism.
Hogg doesn't know if Judge Adams really gets it, but she says the conversation was productive. For now, Hogg says, that feels like justice.
You know, this little town is making big moves, just like all these other places.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sydney Bowles in Whitesburg, Kentucky, and this is America Amplified.
That story is part of the America Amplified initiative. America Amplified is a national public media collaboration focused on community engagement reporting. Coming up, we'll hear a recorded performance by the late blues musician Nat Rees and hear from fans of Appalachian old-time music in Wales.
Learning their style and, yeah, I guess keeping a lot of songs alive and introducing it to new people is quite important.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board.
Black and blue, blue, well, give you them blue. Never felt like this before. You know it will make you feel bad. It will make you feel sad. And I don't want the black and blue, blue no more. I know I've been lucky. I've had trouble all my life. There's not many could stand it, but just a few.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
The story of the West Virginia Mine Wars, a bloody part of our nation's labor history, has been told in film, song, and even modern dance. Seriously. Dancer and choreographer Tonita Akers Toler used the Mine Wars as inspiration for a modern dance piece. Tonita is a native of Raleigh County in southern West Virginia, and she's the founder and managing artistic director of the West Virginia Dance Company, the only professional touring dance company in the state. Inside Appalachia Folkways reporter Jordan Lovejoy is a former dance student of Tonita's. Last year, before the pandemic, Jordan visited one of Tonita's recent dances and has this story.
In 1977, when Tonita Akers Toler graduated from the Conservatory of the Arts at Point Park College in Pittsburgh, she had a choice to make as a dancer. move to a city like New York, or return home to West Virginia.
And I did ponder that heavily because I loved the dance in New York. But you know what? I love my mom and dad. And I love the mountains, and that's, I just love home.
She chose West Virginia, and she founded the Appalachian Dance and Music Ensemble, which would later be known as the West Virginia Dance Company.
People laugh at me for saying this, but I wanted to share dance with my people. So I felt there was a need here. We had lots of excellent dance schools, but we didn't have any really thing intensely in modern dance at all. And we didn't have a professional touring dance company.
Building a modern dance company in a heavily rural space like West Virginia may have seemed like a long shot to some, but Tanita sees it differently.
I personally feel that I have had more of an opportunity to grow and to learn because I am here. I don't know, I just feel like a lot of us would not have gotten the opportunities to grow as artists if we weren't here.
Her dance company travels widely to rural communities throughout West Virginia, performing in a variety of spaces. Because there aren't the same resources that big cities have, they often manage their own light design, sound production, costuming, promotion, booking, and grant writing. It's a similar situation for many other artists in rural areas.
Because the struggle also brings knowledge.
Tanita's longtime friend and co-artistic director of the West Virginia Dance Company, dancer Donald Laney, sees another advantage: the low cost of living.
Where else can I make a living in the arts and not pick up any other jobs? So I've never had a real job. Like, I've always done the arts, you know what I mean? So, and Tanita's created that for us, which is amazing, you know, because most people don't think West Virginia would have something like this.
The company has always been committed to telling Appalachian stories through dance. Over the years, they've performed pieces that explore labor history, literature by writers from the area, the struggles of addiction, and even the relationship between people and the environment. For Tanita, art is communication. And modern dance is communication through the language of movement. It's really the same storytelling process a writer uses. But instead of selecting words to tell a story, Tanita and Donald carefully choose unique movements.
So, I mean, we train our bodies, so our bodies tell stories.
And every piece works differently.
Modern dance encompasses so many different styles of language communication. You know, it can be extremely abstract and totally just about different energies of the human body, juxtapositions of those. It can be a piece that has an idea and incorporates an audience.
An encounter with West Virginia glassmaker Ron Hinkle sparked the idea for one of Tanita's more recent pieces. Her son gave her a vase made by Hinkle, and then she heard him speak about his glassmaking craft at an arts conference. He mentioned that people thought his workers looked like they were dancing. Like dancers, glassmakers often have to move quickly and with precise intention to create their pieces before the glass cools and hardens.
He said, so many people have said it's like we're dancing. And he said, I've always wanted to, you know, see a dance about that. And I went, oh.
Tanita wanted to thank Hinkle for the vase he made. And their conversation inspired her to create a performance piece based on his work. The piece is called Catching Light. Tanita and Donald often work with West Virginia artists and musicians to create a uniquely local sonic experience, like in Catching Light. In the score, we hear a focus on elements like the sizzle of fire and the vibration of air as a finger glides across the top of a wine glass. On stage, six dancers wear glistening, iridescent pants to give the appearance of glass. Their bodies move through yoga-type shapes and angles to suggest glass transitioning from liquid to solid. A A few minutes into the piece, a voice begins narrating the process of making glass. That voice belongs to West Virginia storyteller and musician Adam Booth. He also scored the music for the section of the dance we're hearing. And during a performance of Catching Light, Booth's narration plays through speakers as the dancers move with his words. Here's Booth narrating the beginning steps of glassmaking in the dance.
We start the process with the gathering of the glass in the furnace. What we have in the furnace is molten, clear glass. It's like a crucible in there. We take the punty, which is the blowpipe, and accumulate glass on the end. We spin the punty and dip its end into the pool of molten glass. Right now, the glass is formless.
As Booth speaks, the dancers swirl into different directions across the stage. They fling pieces of flowy white fabric to represent the chaotic movement of hot, liquid glass as the spinning blowpipe pulls it from the fire.
Then, we roll the glass on a slab of iron or carbon. This is called marvering, and is where the glass begins to take form.
The dancers spin forward and kneel like rolled glass. Their quick and precise movements mirror glass being shaped by a maker. Next, the dancers spin upwards into a standing position, as if their bodies were being pulled by an unseen hand. For a brief moment, they focus on their hands, palms open and facing up, before they are swirled and twirled across the stage again, their iridescent pants shimmering as they reflect the stage lights. Their bodies are like pieces of glass catching light. Adam Booth's narration and the dancers' movements also illustrate and interpret other parts of the glassmaking process. Fusing different pieces together, raking and picking designs into the glass, or forming bubbles by dipping a piece into an optic mold. As the first half of the piece ends, Booth's voice draws our focus back to the connection between dancer and glassmaker. Careful, intentional movement in the process of creation.
But the hands and the breath and the mind of the artist are the real tools that give life to the molten glass.
In order to get it to live and become a bigger structure, the human being actually breathes into the art form, so part of their chemistry is always in that piece of art.
The living gives life to that which is inanimate. Or is it inanimate? Perhaps the glass only joins with us to find life and give a blessing.
For Tanita, one of the key fascinations she had with glass was its human element. The glass's transformation from solid to liquid to solid again could only be performed by the body and breath of a craftsperson. Similarly, a dance only comes to life by the body and breath of the dancers, especially as they perform the story for an audience. The audience, says Tanita, brings the final crucial element to the dance. Without them, there would be no story to share. And modern dance is a shared storytelling event between dancer and spectator.
They would have a certain feeling about the whole thing, but it leaves the 50% where they can bring their own experiences into watching it, and then they could have their own story.
This relationship built through storytelling became evident to me at a recent West Virginia Dance Company performance. After the dance, the audience had a chance to talk with the dancers and choreographers about the performance. Here's what audience members Larry Davis, Marcus Fioravante, and Ethan Sir had to say about their experience.
You have made so much difference in this space right here with your choreography and dancing and performing and everything.
Anything I go to see any performance for is just, it's just part of capturing that magic and the love of the art.
I know it's very narrative, it's very expressive. And so I guess I'm just trying to be swept along for the journey.
And that shared storytelling experience with fellow West Virginians is exactly what Tanita hoped to accomplish.
Thank you for coming to share, because it doesn't mean a thing for us to write our stories in movement without you. So thank you so much. Enjoy.
This event was one of the West Virginia Dance Company's last live performances before the pandemic forced them to cancel the rest of their season. But they have been doing some digital performances online, and Tanita says they hope to resume their in-person performances as soon as it's safe. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Jordan Lovejoy.
To see a video recording of the West Virginia Dance Company performing Catching Light, you can visit our website, wvpublic.org. Summertime is normally a time for summer festivals. You may have had to put your festivity plans on hold this summer. The guest in our final story did too. Have you ever heard of Clifftop Festival in West Virginia? Vandalia? The Fiddlers Convention in Galax, Virginia? People from all over the world travel to these festivals, intermingling and swapping tunes. All of these gatherings were canceled this year because of the pandemic. This affected old-time music fans from across Appalachia and across the ocean. As we've been finding through our ongoing series about Appalachia and Wales, both regions have similarities through coal, mountainous landscapes, folktales, and music. And our Folkways reporter Caitlin Tan discovered there's a growing community of musicians from both Wales and Appalachia who share an interest in the culture that binds us together.
Ben McManus is an instrument musician who lives in Aberystwyth, Wales. As a teenager, he was instantly captivated when he heard music from our part of the globe.
I came back from high school one day and the gardeners were playing bluegrass, like really loudly out of a boombox. And I was just like, wow, what is this music?
From that first bluegrass song, he was hooked. He searched for more music like it, and that led him to Appalachian old time, which is older than bluegrass. In fact, the string music played here in Appalachia has cultural roots from all over northern Africa, Europe, and the British Isles, including Wales. Ben fell in love with Appalachian string music so much that he eventually traveled to West Virginia to learn more from the musicians here. He took fiddle classes at the Augusta Heritage Center in Elkins and played at the Clifftop Appalachian String Band Festival, a world-renowned old-time music fest in southern West Virginia. It's been going on for 30 years. Meanwhile, in Wales, there's another music festival called Fire in the Mountain. It's named after an Appalachian fiddle tune. This festival includes a growing culture of musicians in Wales who are also interested in the music of Appalachia. Ben says it's the closest thing to Clifftop that he's found.
There's like a river runs right through the middle of it, so there's a lot of chilling out and just music everywhere, folk music everywhere. But it's just a big four-day party on a beautiful farm in the middle of Wales.
This music exchange goes both ways. Musicians Carl Jones and Aaron Marshall live in Galax, Virginia. They travel the world teaching and performing old-time music, but one of their favorite places to go is Wales.
You might hear bluegrass and old-time, and then you might hear somebody sing a Welsh song. You might hear somebody do an old-time or bluegrass song and sing it in Welsh.
Aaron and Carl were going to attend Fire in the Mountain this year for the first time, but it was canceled because of the pandemic. From Georgia, but one of his first music trips to Wales, he was surprised.
We met a lot of singing farmers, and they looked a lot like me. I said, hey, That was kind of a shock to me. I said, wow, these guys look sort of like I look. That's interesting. And they were singers, really good singers. I'm not saying I'm a good singer, but I did really feel an affinity to just the geography and the location felt very comfortable to me, and I love going to Wales.
Carl recently took a DNA test and discovered that many of his ancestors came from Great Britain. He says he'd like to believe that many of them were from Wales. Erin is originally from Canada, but she fell in love with Appalachia about 25 years ago. She devoted years to learning old-time music from the people here, and she says she wants to ensure that their music lives on.
You know, we're all links in the rope of tradition, you know, strands in that rope. And it's really important for me to share what those musicians shared with me. They were very generous.
Musical traditions evolve as they pass to different cultures and continents. But there are many elements of this music that haven't changed for centuries, even after traveling thousands of miles. This is an old-time tune Erin is playing called Love, Nancy. It's an Appalachian song. But it actually originated from an older song from the British Isles.
It came to West Virginia, and other people learned it, like myself as well. It's beautiful. Many of the words long forgotten.
This interconnection between Welsh immigrants and Appalachian string music has also fascinated folklorist Jerry Milnes.
I don't know of any culture who came here who didn't bring some music with them.
Jerry's the former folk arts coordinator at the Augusta Heritage Center. And in his interviews with people here over the years, he's discovered hints of Welsh influence in our culture.
There's a whole list of towns with real Welsh-sounding names. Certainly, for one thing, there's an awful lot of Welsh surnames that are involved currently and in the past with old-time traditional music in West Virginia.
Many Welsh people immigrated to Appalachia in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And although there isn't a lot of written history about this group of immigrants, Jerry says he's got a hunch that there are more cultural connections with Wales than we realize. Ben McManus agrees. Remember, he's the Welsh musician who fell in love with Appalachian old time. He's been digging into the history of music that the people of Wales would have been playing in the late 1600s, just before so many of them immigrated to Appalachia. In fact, he says there's very little recorded history of the music and culture from that time. He thinks that's perhaps because the British invasion and oppression of the country wiped out much of that history. A lot of the Welsh folk music of today had to be rewritten in the following centuries. So Ben says he recognizes the importance of keeping traditional music alive, which includes Appalachian old time.
Obviously, being like a Welsh guy on the other side of the world, like, it's kind of, well, not taking someone else's tradition, but it's like learning their style. And yeah, I guess keeping a lot of songs alive and introducing it to new people is quite important.
Today, cross-cultural exchange of Appalachian old-time music is on hold this year, at least in person. Erin and Carl have their sights set on Fire in the Mountain next year, and so does Ben. In fact, he's planning to be in West Virginia too, playing old-time music across the mountain state when it's hopefully safe in 2021. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tam.
Culture can connect us to our kindred spirits across great distances, even during a global pandemic. Culture helps build bridges in other ways, too. Earlier in our show, we heard from several people standing up, speaking out against racism. They talked about how reckoning with our history and looking at it frankly and openly is a path to acknowledging some of the current injustices in our society. It's something that actually takes a lot of courage and faith. I've been learning a lot lately about brutal and violent realities our country was built upon. I don't know about you, but I've been relying a lot on the poets, artists, writers, and musicians to not only gain some access to understanding, but also to glimpse healing. I worry it's still way too early to talk about hope, given all that has yet to be reckoned with. But if there's hope to be had, I think it might be found in the folds of the cultural fabrics that we share, threads that stretch across imaginary geographical boundaries to comfort and ground us. Thinking about all of those folks from Wales and Canada who come to Appalachia to study traditional music reminded us here at Inside Appalachia of the banjo player Kaya Cater. Kaya is from Quebec, but she studied at Davis and Elkins College in Elkins, West Virginia. She's since moved back, but she still has strong ties here in Appalachia through the music she came to study. Kaya's dad is from Grenada. The instrument she plays, the banjo, originally came from West Africa, brought to the American South by men and women who were slaves. Here she is, playing a song in her native French Canadian. It's called Petit Chagrin, which means little sorrow.
Voilà comment t'es resté là, mon petit chagrin. J'en ai pas des fleurs du même, lui qui boude d'après mon cœur, berceur du vent. Il y a mon dos si à pombre, c'est là et où il a pris substance de mon espoir. Voilà comment.
Till next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WKMS in Murray, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, and the Ohio Valley Resource. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Other music this week is provided by Kaya Cater, Nat Reese, and Dinosaur Burps. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Xander Alloy and Kyle Bass also helped produce our show this week. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/insideappalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. You can also subscribe or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.